jiggery pokery. And no, I didn't just use a swear word. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst, and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Yeah, good to be back in the studio again. I kind of pre-made stuff for while we were at camp. So we haven't actually sat down across the table from one another in 2 or 3 weeks. So that's because, you know, things happen, so we pre-make shows.
Other than at camp, when the last time I think you and I were doing an event together like we do when we record, you were wearing a blue cape and I was wearing a red cape.
Well, that's right. I was Constitution Man and you were Declaration Boy, my faithful sidekick.
And folks, before you get the wrong idea, no, we weren't down at the Columbus Pride Festival or anything. It's part of the Constitution game that we play with the campers at camp. Where we help them to dig into the body of the United States Constitution and actually learn how it is put together and how to answer compelling questions in our culture that are facing us from a constitutional perspective. Now, Chuck, this year at camp, we had four different cabin groups this year, made up of somewhere between 3 and 4 kids apiece. Yes, it was a small camp this year, and folks, we're going to be getting out information on next year's camp as soon as we possibly can, because we'd love to see that camp filled out next year. But, Chuck, we had a cabin that set a record. They answered more questions and got more points in that game than any previous cabin had done in the last 15 years we've done this camp. And I'm going to posit right now that possibly we should send invitations to that group of campers to take a trip to Washington, D.C. to do a symposium for Chief Justice John Roberts on how the Constitution is supposed to be read.
Yeah, because let's face it, as regarding original intent, our campers at Camp American were much better informed than John Roberts and 5 other justices that's sitting on the Supreme Court.
Yes.
And, you know, Barry, when this thing went back up before the Supreme Court, I'll be quite honest, I assumed, and maybe this was, you know, this is what goes wrong. I assumed that what we were going to get out of this particular, the ACA case, I'm trying to remember what the name of the case was. It doesn't really matter. We all know what we're talking about. We're talking about the Obamacare case that was up before the Supreme Court. I assumed we were going to get some kind of a split decision because the courts love, especially the Supreme Court, loves to give everybody a bone. They like to do it. They think that they're playing good politics by throwing a bone to every side. Well, let me tell you, no bone was thrown to the side of the anti-Obamacare people and the pro-free market. I don't want to say anti-Obamacare. I don't like that anti-language. Mm-hmm. It basically makes us look like we're all going around, oh, I'm just against it. No, I'm for a free market approach to health care.
Absolutely.
And there were no bones thrown to the free market approach to health care people at all. This was all basically all for socialized medicine, period. And the way it was done was essentially preliminary reports. I don't remember. Nobody's had time except for the justices to really parse it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, but the crux of the issue in King versus Burwell, which is the case that, you know, we're taping this on Thursday afternoon prior to our Saturday show, and it's late in the afternoon, and earlier this afternoon, actually probably around midday, there was an announcement made from the United States Supreme Court of their decision in King versus Burwell. And the decision was a 6-3 vote in favor of upholding Obamacare. And in much the same way they upheld the original challenge to the law, they upheld this current challenge. And that is to basically take words that constitute the Affordable Care Act and reinterpret them so that it would fit a perspective that the justices in the majority consider constitutional. Now, folks, just a little quick Constitution 101 here. The proper role of the United States Supreme Court in dealing with challenges to a federal law passed by Congress is what, Charles? Is it A, to invalidate that law? Is it B, to interpret that law in light of the Constitution? Or is it C, to redefine terms so that you can restructure the law in order to fit what you believe the intended meaning of Congress actually was in passing it?
Well, you could argue that Congress has, or that the Supreme Court has no power to invalidate a law, period.
Oh, exactly.
First of all,
answer A was a trick, and I'm glad you picked up on it.
B, the Supreme Court has no right to redefine words in order to make something legal or illegal because A, they are, or valid or invalid, because they have no right to validate or invalidate a law.
Exactly. Now, they can only look at a statute in light of the Constitution and determine whether or not that statute, as it stands by itself, is within the purview of the legitimate, enumerated, or implied powers of the law, only lawmaking body that the Constitution allows, which is Congress. And that is the extent of their decision-making power.
Well,
until now.
Yeah, okay, people always say, well, who's got the final say? Well, actually, the final say are the state legislatures, and
right.
Above that are the people. So that's where the final say is. Now, people say, well, then what's the Supreme Court for? Well, the Supreme Court is designed to hear cases of equity and law under the Constitution. Now, what does that mean? Well, case law, which is what the Supreme Court is ruling on in the cases of King versus Burwell and many, Roe v. Wade, name it. Those decisions are supposed to apply only to the litigants. Each litigant is supposed to bring their own case before the Supreme Court. Now, John Marshall expanded the court's powers to do judicial review of the law. And that itself has expanded over time into this. It has morphed into this idea that we have federal legislators who are appointed for life, which judges are not, that sit in this court and are allowed to basically make up law as they go along. That's exactly what the Constitution didn't do. The Constitution gave the court the right to, sit in judgment over the law for a specific set of litigants. Now, what Congress could do is take a look at a decision made by the Supreme Court and say, okay, we see an issue because they found that way for these litigants. If another case comes before the court, they'll probably find that way again. We'd better find out if there's constitutional reason to do the thing that we've done, or perhaps the court has a point and we made a mistake. That's not the way things work these days.
No. As a matter of fact, the way things work is how we opened this program, Jiggery Pokery.
Yes.
And for those of you who are completely unfamiliar with that post-cultural reference, it's actually something from the episodes of Doctor Who on the BBC when he's talking about somebody doing something that's strange or out of the ordinary or not normal or doing something in a way to try to make things up as you go along. And they're engaging in a bit of jiggery pokery, they say. Sometimes we used to call that, making it up as you go along. But that's what the majority in the United States Supreme Court, led by, drumroll please, Chief Justice John G. Roberts, has done exactly in the King versus Burwell case. John Roberts, who in the original case against the Affordable Care Act, changed definitions that were in the law and that were affirmed by people in the administration who testified in front of the Supreme Court during that trial, or that hearing back in 2012, that a penalty was really a tax, and so therefore it fell within the taxing powers of Congress, and therefore the Affordable Care Act was constitutional because it was a tax, it wasn't a penalty. And And many people thought that maybe Roberts wanted a do-over on that, and that King versus Burwell was his chance of getting out from under what was a very bad bit of jurisprudence in his decision-making in the original Affordable Care Act case, which was the Cuccinelli versus the United States.
Ken Cuccinelli,
who was the Attorney General of Virginia.
And a great guy, by the way.
Right. But in King versus Burwell, John Roberts channeled his inner John Kasich, if I can say it this way. he doubled down on his error. He basically went out and said, okay, when they say that that subsidies, federal subsidies, apply to exchanges established by the states, that what Congress really meant by that phrase was that it were established by the states or the federal government, either one. In other words, completely broadening the scope of the congressional language and doing so in a way to say, well, because we can't understand why they wouldn't have done it, they must have meant it this way. But, Charles, that is not constitutionally sound or even
entomologically sound
jurisprudence.
No, it's not. Entomology is basically the study of words.
Yes, that's right.
And what words mean, and how they got to mean that.
But what we have is John Roberts showing that no matter what, he philosophically is committed to having Obamacare stay established as legitimate statute.
Well, if you recall the first ruling, and we pointed this out, and we weren't the only ones, if Obamacare really is if the penalty really is a tax, it's still unconstitutional because of where the bill started. Because it's a requirement in the U.S. Constitution that all revenue bills start in the House of Representatives.
Absolutely.
And where did the Affordable Care Act, where was it introduced first?
Well, it was a Senate bill.
It was a Senate bill.
It was a Senate bill. But Charles, as you understand now, I'm pretty sure that probably we don't need John Roberts to triple down on this, but if words such as "if it originates in the states" means the state or the federal government, and if words such as "penalty" actually means tax, then the word "originate" can mean at any point in its life it showed up in that chamber.
Exactly. Because words
don't have any fixed meanings.
Don't have any fixed meanings.
Folks, we are looking at the fruit of postmodernist thought when there are no absolutes, when there are no fixed meanings. But this is a man who, during his confirmation hearing, when George Bush put him up to be Chief Justice, said that he followed the doctrine of stare decisis, and that he was, if I remember correctly, I think he also claimed to be a strict constructionist.
No, you can't get confirmed Chief Justice of the Supreme Court or even an associate justice by saying you're a constructionist these days. You get into kind of long-winded discussions on natural law.
If you recall, he went to natural law theory. That's right. I forgot about that. But you know, Charles, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm going to poke a bear here. All right. So, you know what, folks? If you don't like it, too bad. Too bad. The pain will go away shortly. But
poke away.
But the after effects may not. And that is, I hope that this ruling today, and we know that there's another ruling coming probably Monday that's going to be even worse than this, most likely, given this as an indicator, that this ruling today puts to bed once and for all the fantasy that many social conservatives has of we can rein in the courts by just electing the right guy as president, and then we can get in justices who will hold to the Constitution, because John Roberts was their fantasy pick.
You hit on something I was saving up to say. Can we please once and for all put away the notion that A, George W. Bush was a conservative, and B, that he appointed conservative justices?
Well, and I don't care. You could replace any name for George W. Bush. You can replace it with Ronald Reagan, because he gave us Sandra Day O'Connor.
And Kennedy.
And Anthony Kennedy, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. You can blame Bill Clinton all you want. You can blame Barack Obama for, you know, Sotomayor, et cetera. But the key is that when it gets right down to it, conservatives, whether social or otherwise, or culturally conservative, I wouldn't call them social conservatives because some of them run from certain tenets of social conservatism, but they could call themselves culturally conservatives, have, and you've heard it ad infinitum, ad nauseum, and so have I. Oh, we've just got to get our guy in as president, and then he'll fix the courts by appointing good justices. Gee, what's the last 40 years track record look like?
Yeah.
Hasn't happened, ladies and gentlemen. Not with Rinaldus Magnus, not with God H.W. Bush, you know, not with God W. Bush. And it certainly isn't going to happen with any of the crop that may be coming out of 2016, regardless of who and that miasm of pretenders is going to end up becoming the nominee.
Interesting you bring this up because I just ran across an article. Now, see, ladies and gentlemen, we're recording this on the day that the decision comes out. So Right. Stuff is still coming out on this as we speak. I'm going to send this over to Barry in a second because he doesn't have it yet. But on a website called The Gateway Pundit.
Okay.
Here's an article by Jim Hoft. And the headline is Senator Jeff Sessions on SCOTUS care decision. SCOTUS care, don't you love that?
Well, and that's something we're going to talk about here in a few minutes because there was a very scathing dissent issued by a actual true strict constructionist justice on the court by the name of Antonin Scalia, who honestly actually took his fellow Chief Justice John Roberts directly to the woodshed by name in his dissent. We're going to talk a little bit more about that, but go ahead and continue on.
Okay, in the name of this article, Senator Sessions on SCOTUS care decision, this should dispel the illusion that we can rely on judges to save us.
Thank you very much. And folks, again, I want to make sure that you understand that this isn't we're not trying to slam on anybody, but we have to start thinking constitutionally. Now, I saw a little bit of a discussion earlier where somebody invoked Alexander Hamilton as a reason for why the John Roberts' decision was so bad that he was like, you know, going counter to what Alexander Hamilton believed that the justices should be doing, well, which just showed me one thing, Charles. This individual hasn't really understood that the Federalist Papers, especially Hamilton's contributions to the Federalist Papers, were propaganda.
Yes.
And they were actually supposed to lead you one direction while hiding from you another direction. I know I'm speaking heresy to many of the folks who love Alexander Hamilton, and the only thing I've ever grown up or gotten fed on in American history and government is the Federalist Papers, and they've never read the Anti-Federalist, nor they've never read any of the background of Hamilton's mad goal to try to create a second British monarchy in the colonies after the War for Independence was won.
Okay, here's what Hamilton said, and he was lying. I will not say that he misspoke. I will not say he was mistaken. He was lying. What he said in Federalist Number 78, part of this is a paraphrase, but Hamilton says that the judiciary branch of the proposed government would be the weakest of the three because it had, quote, no influence over either the sword or the purse. It may be truly said to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment. Wrong.
Exactly.
Wrong, because he would have been correct if the Congress and the executive branch would do what it's supposed to do to rein in the judiciary. And we have places where basically the President of the United States has said things like, well, the Supreme Court has rendered its decision. Now let them enforce it. That was a rather infamous case. And unfortunately, the President of the United States was on the wrong side of the issue when he said that. It was Andrew Jackson. It had to do with the the displacement of the Cherokees and the Choctaws and the Creeks and the Chickasaws and the Seminoles to Oklahoma, mm-hmm. known as the Trail of Tears. And basically, John Marshall said, don't do that. You can't do that constitutionally. And Jackson did it anyway. So, you know, here we have a demonstration of the correct way to do things and the wrong way to implement it. But that being said, Hamilton was simply lying. Hamilton's plan all along, he did not get what he wanted at the Constitutional Convention. So his plan was to go ahead and get it by the appointment of judges and the use of appointing Federalist judges to steer the government and to interpret his desires for what the Constitution was to become into the Constitution. And let me tell you, that was a very successful strategy. The Anti-Federalists were essentially who had really held sway at the beginning of the Republic, despite the fact that Washington was a Federalist. He did have Anti-Federalists in his cabinet. By the time, by around 1825 or 1830, the Federalists essentially held sway, and the federal government was essentially the big player, and the states were all being rapidly shunted off to the side.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Which was exactly what the Anti-Federalists wanted to avoid.
Right, and that's true. And so what you end up with is a situation now that we're really living in Hamilton's preferred world. And honestly, John Roberts didn't, you know, ignore or disparage Hamilton's legacy. He actually lifted it up to its next level with this decision.
Yes.
Because what he did was he now has equated the idea of a state doing something, completely equated it with the federal government action doing something. And Chuck, I must ask, at that point, what functional use is a state?
Well,
if in jurisprudence, if you use the word state, it can be interchanged with any action of the federal body, then what purpose is the political entity known as a state?
Well, the Federalists wanted at the convention to eliminate the states as anything other than administrative districts. So basically what has happened with this decision
is they've become administrative districts.
They have become administrative districts.
And if they choose not to administer a program, that doesn't halt the program, i.e. Obamacare and the exchanges. It just opens the door for the federal entity to take the place of the state and thus become the super administrator.
Exactly. By the way, here's what Sessions...
In other words, the federal government now acts in loco parentis when the state can't take care of itself.
Yeah, in the place of parents. All right. Here's what Jeff Sessions actually said. Quote, the Supreme Court's Obamacare acrobatics should dispel for good the comforting illusion that we can rely on judges to save us, whether on socialized medicine, executive amnesty, or any other action which erodes our Constitution and the authority of Congress. Conservatives will have to rally the everyday voting citizen. There is no greater power than winning the trust and loyalty of the American people. We will need to put down the donor agenda, pick up the banner of the American worker, and carry it to victory. Well, okay. He's absolutely correct. All you have to do is take a look at what Congress has been doing, especially the House under John Boehner, when they're actually firing subcommittee chairs for bucking the leadership on the whole TIP business, the supposedly free trade agreement with Asia that isn't free trade at all. It's essentially more global governance and crony capitalism in the form of handouts to big corporations and little guys pay the price. The fact is that in case you weren't, nobody was paying attention, it got a little hot for John Boehner. Hot enough, in fact, that some of the dismissed subcommittee chairs were taken back. Now, whether they had to sign some kind of loyalty oath or something, who knows?
Yeah, it's hard to say.
It's hard to say. And if they're if these guys are serving in subcommittee posts as leadership, they're already more or less on the team anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
The reason I can tell you that what they did was they went to Boehner and to some of the other guys in leadership and said, "Well, you know, we got tremendous pressure from home. If we vote for this thing, there's a good chance we'll face a Tea Party challenge." Yeah, you're right. And Boehner's already got a Tea Party challenge. He's got a Tea Party challenge on his next re-election campaign. And Boehner, I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find out if Boehner won re-election but didn't get re-elected to the to the speakership and resigned. Because that's what these guys do. I don't want to serve if I can't be
Eric
the boss.
Eric Cantor, as soon as he lost his primary, he was out of there.
He booked. Yeah.
Now, and Chuck, you know, it's what we're getting down to here is, and I do want to get around before too long to Justice Scalia's dissent, because it was basically a work of, it ranks right up there with Shakespeare, and his problem is he was writing describing fictions, not actually writing fiction himself. But it's startling, folks, because the four mainly liberal justices, Kagan, Sotomayor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Stephen Breyer, went with who the usual swing vote is, Anthony Kennedy and Chief Justice John Roberts, to basically give the Obama administration and the federal government, including the IRS, all the firepower they could possibly hope to have, and basically has all but assured that there is not going to be any relief short of Congress actually
repealing,
finding the chemical fortitude to grow a backbone,
you did that very well.
Thank you. And to form a backbone and actually take on their constitutional responsibility and kill the monster, and tell the court and the administration both who actually has the most power in the federal government, which is Congress. Now, that's Constitution lesson number two, ladies and gentlemen.
Right.
You've been told a lie for the vast majority of your lives. I don't care how young or old you are listening to this program. You have been fed a lie in your civics, government, social studies, blah, 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 American problems classes, that we have three co-equal branches of government, and that's how our founders set it up. They absolutely did not.
No, they sure didn't.
But that's what Alexander Hamilton, and when he wrote his pieces in The Federalist, wanted you to believe. Actually, the Congress has the most power, because if you look in both Article 2 and Article 3, which is the executive branch, the presidency, and cabinet, and Article 3 for the judiciary, the Supreme Court, and other federal courts, each one of those articles has specific language where Congress has a specific check on the powers of those other two branches. Now, the only check the executive has on Congress is a veto on legislation which Congress can override. The only check, legitimately, that the Supreme Court has on Congress is saying that a law that they passed wasn't within one of their enumerated powers and therefore is unconstitutional, but Congress can come back and do two things to them. They can repass the bill again and say, try it one more time and see if you can get this right. Or they can remove the authority from the courts to hear cases regarding that particular exercise of the congressional power.
Exactly. And there are only a very few cases where they can't do that.
And those are, there's about a half a dozen, listed of about a half a dozen circumstances.
And most of them have to do with international law.
That's right. So you've been told a lie for most of your lives. You're not going to hear it on this program because we don't buy the foregone conclusion that, oh, you know, this our great government's so great because everybody's equal. No, that's not true, especially not in the three power branches of our government. The congressional, the legislative branch, is the one who controls the most power.
By far.
And if they would just pay attention to that and work within their constitutional parameters, they could take care of quite a few of these problems. As a matter of fact, one of their options right now, Charles, other than negating the law, zero funding it, whatever they wanted to do with it, is another little piece where they could actually bring impeachment charges against John Roberts for this decision. because what he's now done has told them what their intent was. He has redefined their intent, and that is outside of his power, even as Chief Justice of the United States.
It's well beyond their power.
And therefore, he has, in some minds, especially mine, maybe only in mine, but that's okay. I'm okay to being a party of one. He has engaged in impeachable activity.
Oh, absolutely, he has.
And frankly, I would like to see, whether it's a Jeff Sessions, a Rand Paul, a Ted Cruz, a Daniel Webster, or Jim Jordan, or someone, because I know it won't be a Mitch McConnell or a John Boehner.
You
because
know that for
that
sure.
would upset the party cart that they're all trying to ride on. Bring charges, bring articles of impeachment against John Roberts. Because what he's done, and he's admittedly done, is he's redefined words in order to create something that the Constitution does not allow the federal government to do. And that is impeachable. Now, is it going to happen? Are you going to see anybody bring our... You might see a junior member somewhere in the Tea Party, like a Dave Brad or somebody. Yeah, they might file a bill. They might file articles of impeachment. It won't get a hearing.
No, it'll go to a committee and it'll be
quashed and it'll be done.
It will have a stake driven directly through its heart.
And that's because it's easy for Congress to do the blame game. So when people are upset about the full impact of Obamacare, it isn't Congress's fault anymore. It's now
The Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court's fault.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that's the kind of buck passing that has been done by Congress for so long because, I mean, let's face it, it's a lucrative operation at this point about the only guy who hasn't been elected to Congress who didn't make millions of dollars from it was Ron Paul. And what did he get for it? He got excoriated and called a nutcase and blah, blah, blah. Because he didn't play the game. That's the problem. Everybody plays the game. John Kasich played the game while he was in Washington, and now he plays the game while he's in Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
With great hopes to get back to D.C. as the head of it all, which is not going to happen at this point. And I sent Barry an article that I thought we might be discussing today, and I don't think we're going to at this point, but basically that Ohio, thanks to nonsense like Medicaid expansion and that kind of thing, among other things, is one of the highest tax states in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And people are leaving here directly because of the taxes. So don't be fooled by these drops in the income tax. Yeah, the state income tax is falling, but everything else is going up.
Well, yeah, because that's the interesting bait and switch. And, you know, when is a penalty a fee is a tax? Which, I guess in one sense, I would agree with John Roberts. Yeah, when they said penalty, they actually meant tax, because that's the ultimate goal anytime a government agent says that they're imposing fees or penalties. That's just so they can get out from under saying that actually in its effect, it's a tax. But if it's a penalty is something that happens after the action or you refuse to take the action, a tax is upon the completion of an action. And so there's differing directional issues that you have to deal with. And that's part of the reason why Roberts' first decision for Obamacare, was so odious, is because he doesn't know which way is up. If it's a penalty, a penalty is put on somebody for not taking an action. A tax is put on somebody who takes an action or buys something because that it's been loaded up with the government needs a piece of this when you spend your money on it.
Well, he can just issue a ruling if it gets upside down that says down is up and up is down, and voila, he's perfectly upright. It's everybody else who's upside down.
Okay, can you show me where the memory hole is? Because it's really starting to feel like Orwell may have been onto something.
It's interesting you bring that up, and it's interesting I don't know if you knew this or not, maybe you did, this jiggery-pokery thing.
Yes.
You know, Scalia made that comment directly.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
he called the Roberts' opinion especially, he called jiggery-pokery and sheer applesauce.
Yeah, I'm afraid to even start in on the applesauce comment, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah, interpretive jiggery-pokery, and accused his colleagues of somersaults of statutory interpretation.
Yes, yes.
And that's exactly where we are, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, we're not the only ones noticing it. Even, for instance, Rush Limbaugh's come out and basically said, okay, this basically means that the law means whatever they want it to mean anytime they want it to mean it. Anybody who's dealt with administrative law, OSHA, FDA, name one, Department of Agriculture, has run into this. That basically, I'm wading through FDA regulations right now, and they're written in such a way that they can mean whatever any given agent wants them to mean at any given time.
Yes.
So if I might think I'm in complete compliance, and someone can say, well, no, those words don't actually mean that.
Or they don't mean that to me, and I'm the one who's making the decision.
Exactly.
Exactly.
That's the kind of society we have melded into with the adoption of these postmodern principles where words don't mean things. I mean, we can see it played out in other areas of society. Now, I don't want to expand too much beyond the boundaries, but... okay, we've just come through a controversy. Really, it's not all that controversial unless you really are truly postmodern. And that is, we have a man who claims to be a woman and identifies as a woman and has surgery to appear to be a woman and has taken hormones to exhibit some of the characteristics of women. Does that make him a woman? Well, the answer is no. He continues to be a man. Perhaps a poor excuse for one, but nonetheless, he's a man because he has on his 23rd pair of chromosomes, one is X and one is Y.
Mm-hmm.
You can't change that with chemicals. You can't change that with genetic therapy. You can't change that with hormones. You can't change that with surgery. The fact is, he is still a man. Now, we had the same kind of thing, very different in one respect, but very much the same. We had a woman who was the head of the NAACP in Seattle.
Seattle,
I think.
Washington, yes.
Rachel, I don't know how to pronounce it. Dolezal is the way I pronounce the name. Who has, quote unquote, claimed she was black. African American. I frankly don't care for that. She's a person of color. When in fact, her parents say no. She is European, Caucasian. They have pictures to prove it of her in her teens, and she has very light skin and freckles light-colored hair. And now she has gotten a perm, so she has kinkier hair. She wears dark makeup. There are drugs you can take to darken your skin, force you to... express melanin more than you have in the past. And she claims she identifies as black, and therefore she is. Well, she's no more black than I am. Or she's no more black than Caitlyn/Bruce Jenner is a woman. The fact is that we cannot become something we're not simply by identifying as something else. And you can't make the law say something it doesn't say by simply saying it's something else. As I said, we're seeing these things play out in society in different ways. Now, what decision is going to come out? You know, we talked about a decision that's probably going to come out Monday after this show plays. That's probably going to be bad. Well, that's going to be the marriage cases. And
yeah, absolutely.
And I think the Supreme Court's already basically telegraphed that they have already made that decision. They're just basically trying to, right now, they're applying the sugar coating. I mean, that's the bottom line. They're applying the sugar coating basically to keep Christians, who are not a bunch who are known to take to the streets and throw, Molotov cocktails through windows, and I kind of like it that way.
Yeah, we're not the caricature that the liberals want to paint
us out. No, exactly.
But I do believe with this particular ruling, last week, during camp, I was not at camp for about 3 days in
right.
camp because I was back down here in Columbus, down at the convention center with the Southern Baptist Convention, who were having their national conclave, and their president, Dr. Ronnie Floyd, lit up the assembly during his speech to the convention, where he basically said, "We will engage in civil disobedience. We will not support, if the Supreme Court comes out and redefines marriage, that the SBC, at least, and I believe that they're being joined by pastors all over the country, are basically saying, we will not comply. Period. So, given that, and the fact that there's voices being joined by a larger and larger and larger chorus, including African-American pastors, some Catholics are now standing up. Those who are basically the traditionalists, the Latin Mass type Catholics, are standing up as well. And you're starting to see a growing civil disobedience movement getting ready to happen again. This might make the marches of Dr. Martin Luther King pale in comparison.
It could happen. And there's another issue in that some of the people who were involved, for instance, if you recall the big controversy around the time of the NCAA championships, was what happened in Indiana. Basically, the Chamber of Commerce came in and pulled the rug out from under the Indiana legislature and forced them to take a bill that had given protection to businesses who did not want to be engaged in dealing with same-sex marriage and multiple marriage and all the things that it's going to grow into, who wanted to only be involved in traditional man-woman, single-partner marriages, and turned it into a pro-homosexual housing and employment non-discrimination act, an ENDA. So what's happening now? Well, Mike Pence is apparently in some trouble in Indiana because he caved on this. Mike Pence is the governor of Indiana, former congressman. At one time thought to be, quote-unquote, a potential presidential candidate. Well, not so much now. My question now is, at state level, since the states are now very quickly being broomed under the rug, what's going to be happening at the state levels? Are the states going to step forward and say, okay, we understand that the Supreme Court has said this, but why should businesses have to deal with this issue if they have a spiritual and belief value against deal? In fact, they find it an abomination before God.
Absolutely.
Why should they not be protected from having to deal with it? You know, there are umpteen gazillion cake makers and florists who would be more than happy. They don't care if you're marrying five people. They don't care if you're marrying your horse. They don't care if you're marrying yourself. They'll make you a cake and create a floral arrangement like you wouldn't believe. So what's the only reason you would go to a business that you know would object to it? The only reason is to attempt to force your views on them. Mm-hmm. They are not forcing their views on you. They're simply saying, go someplace else.
That's right.
We all know that there's a gazillion businesses who will deal with you. Go someplace else. Why is it so hard for a state legislator to take a look at that and say, you know, go someplace else. We're going to protect that business. Well, what's the reason, Barry? The Chamber of Commerce doesn't like it. Why doesn't the Chamber of Commerce like it? Because they have nothing to do with conservatism. They are a political organization, and they are riddled with progressives. You know, they give money to the Republican Party. Why do they give money to the Republican Party? They give a lot of money to the Republican Party so they can make the Republican Party more progressive under the guise of being pro-business. I'm sorry, not failing to provide protection for Christian and Jewish businesses and Muslim businesses who do not want to serve in this kind of thing is not under any circumstances conservative or right. It is simply, well, it is progressive ideology writ large. I was talking about, it's funny this comes up because I was talking to my chiropractor today about how we think about the United States of America. When the, you know, when the Constitution was adopted, we viewed ourselves as 13 independent nations who had thrown in together for a specific purpose. We now no longer look at the states like that. We look at the states as merely, you know, geographical entities. And so it used to be that, well, you know, we don't do certain things here in Ohio that they may do in California or Louisiana or New York or Maine. So if you want to do that, go up there and do that, or go over to California and do that, or go down to Louisiana and do that. That, you know, that's there. There's a place for you. You know, they do that there. But that's not the idea now. Now, suddenly, people from New York, California, name a place, say, you have to do it our way. Don't like the gun control laws here? Get a federal law passed. Don't like the marriage laws here, the non-discrimination laws here? Get a national law passed. Well, that's exactly the opposite of why the Constitution was written the way it was. The states had the right to run essentially their internal policies, except for what amount to three things: defense, diplomacy, and trade, period.
Right, exactly.
And the reason they surrendered those particular, their jurisdiction over those areas, was because the United States, in a united front, was more powerful and had more economic power and more military defense capability and better capability on the seas as a united entity. And we had better diplomatic clout as a united entity. It really makes sense.
It does.
And what you could do. You could do what you would do within bounds in your state. There were certain things you couldn't do. You can't declare a dictatorship. You can't operate as a non-republic within the bounds of the United States. That's forbidden. Every state is guaranteed a republican form of government, which means rule by law under a constitution.
Well, it did.
It did.
I'm not so sure, given the direction that the Roberts Court seems to be going, that's true anymore, Charles. I honestly believe that, again, I think our team of 12-year-old and up kids who could win the quizzing of a Constitution game and come up with not only the right answers, but with section articles and sections where it's found and give reasons, really could probably teach John Roberts a thing or three about how the Constitution is structured and how it's supposed to operate. We're really in a situation, Chuck, in this culture right now in this country where they're just making it up as they go along.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, jiggery pokery is, Anton Scalia was right. You know, and he went more. There's a list, I think, on one of the websites of like 15 phrases or quotes out of his dissent that were really, really popular. Or, you know, he just came out and said it. He basically said that, you know, it's not only, you know, unique, it's completely unheard of to approach a decision on an issue in the way that this majority approached it. In other words, what he's saying is, forget stare decisis anymore. They're going to create an entire new body of jurisprudence out of making words say what they want them to say. In other words, we are now looking at the Alice in Wonderland Supreme Court.
We've got a little over 10 minutes left, and I want to ask you a question. When you walked in the door today, I kind of hit you with something, and maybe you hadn't thought about it, or, you know, I didn't give you much time to think about it.
Sure.
And that is, I think this decision changes a whole lot of dynamics with what's going on, especially even right now with the budget in the Ohio State House.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, it may not hit right away, because these guys aren't real good at recognizing that maybe there's been a quantum shift in the way things are going to be operated. But suddenly, you know, there suddenly the ball is back in the court of the of Republicans who are in control both in Washington, D.C., in the Congress, and in a lot of the state houses. What are those Republicans going to do? Because now that basically the choice is now clear. Had the Supreme Court thrown everybody a bone, it would have been a lot more difficult. But the Supreme Court didn't throw everybody a bone. Now, the Republicans can now look at it and say, and I guarantee this is what Boehner and company, well, there's nothing we can do about this.
Exactly.
Or they can say, okay, now we have to repeal the thing.
I don't think you're going to have that second option. I think what's going to happen is they realize it's far too close to a presidential election, and they can't upset all of these voters who are now depending upon both the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid subsidies to the states, and they're just going to meekly, cowardly, draw back into their caves and let the administration and the courts basically do their job for them.
Okay, how long before the amen course? Because I can see where this is going to go. Basically, conservatives are going to come out and tell the Republican side of the field, okay, now we need to know, what's your plan? How are you going to get us out from under this thing?
Well, which is a great position to be in if you're a Republican candidate, because you can say anything you darn well please at this point, and they'll eat it up.
Well,
I'm sorry. Okay, I'm putting on my cynic's hat, Chuck.
Yeah.
Because all this is a field for demagoguery 101 amongst a bunch of candidates who have absolutely no intention of actually doing anything about it.
Right.
Okay, Chris Christie?
Ha! Right.
John Kasich? Mr. God will strike you down if you don't do Medicaid expansion? Please, tell me which one of these people are Donald Trump? He might be your only outside shot, to be quite honest about it.
Not if he's going to have Oprah be his vice president.
Yeah, exactly. So that's his hat tip to the entitlement crowd, I think. Maybe Bobby Jindal. Maybe.
Which is why, basically, there's been... every once in a while, I feel suicidal, so I have a satellite radio in my car, and I turn over to the progressive station.
Oh! Okay, well, we're going to have some deep intervention now, for you. I'm going to talk to your fellow elders.
I didn't say I was going over to the dark side. I said,
no, you did not say that.
No, and what I heard was this. Basically, what they've got to beat on Jindal is the fact that Bobby isn't his real first name.
Oh, my heavens. It's the liberal angst machine going at it hot and heavy.
Yeah. So. He took that name. In fact, they played the Brady Bunch theme because apparently he wanted to be called Bobby because he liked the name Bobby from the Brady Bunch. His real name is something, you know, Indian because his parents are Indians.
Paul Reish or something like that. I forget exactly what it is. But you know what? So what?
Yeah, exactly.
If
Bruce Jenner can be Caitlyn, he can be Bobby.
Doesn't he have the free choice to change his name gender? You know, yeah, exactly. If Brucey Jenner can put on wig and makeup and high heels and try to get out of a murder rap because he's insane, and again, that's the other thing people keep forgetting about with this whole, you know,
his vehicular homicide
gender bending thing is this little vehicular homicide issue he's got facing him because he was busy paying attention to something else and rear-ended somebody and shoved him out into the middle of the traffic in the front of a truck, and they ended up getting killed, and it's his fault.
Yeah.
I thought about that the other day, and I kind of laughed at myself. It's like, maybe he's crazy like a fox because then if he gets sentenced, he goes to women's prison.
Yeah. I don't know. There's a show on called Orange is the New Black.
Which I've proudly never watched. I've only seen
snippets because I don't like that kind of program. But I have seen pictures of the women who are in the show. Guess what? I don't think they look like that in women's prison for the most part.
Well, from my understanding, that one of the women is actually a man who is a transgender.
Yes. And if you saw this person, you would... It's
obvious that there's something not quite
the opposite.
Well,
it's difficult to tell. Now, with Bruce Caitlin, okay, Vanity Fair covers aside, that's a Photoshop deal. I think they pushed Photoshop to its limit with that because, let's face it, he's an athlete. He looks like a guy dressed like a woman. You know, you put have him grow, have 5 days growth in a cigar in his mouth, and it's a comedy routine. So, but that being the case, you know, we've got these guys out there who if the only thing they can find against Jindal is they changed his name. Okay, wow. And he named himself after somebody from the Brady Bunch.
Well, they may have new fodder now because I guess that Willie and Jep Robertson of Duck Dynasty fame have both come out and said that they would vote for him. So now he's going to tie to Phil Robertson. So now he's intolerant. He's bigoted. He's a homophobe. He shouldn't be allowed. A&E should shut down any references to Louisiana whatsoever. Which we can segue over into the whole thing with the Confederate battle flag.
Oh, let's not go there.
Let's not go there because honestly, folks, it's a piece of cloth.
Plus, I think we got about 4 minutes left. So
yeah, so we don't have enough time, we don't have enough time for that one.
So I mean, we are now reaping the whirlwind from having sown the wind. And you know, I'm little taken aback by people who have been convinced since Ronald Reagan got elected in 1980 that they're really winning the battle. And the reason that people think that is that guys like Rush Limbaugh say, well, look, we're winning. Conservatives are winning, blah, blah, blah. And when we get down to the bottom line, the conservatives aren't conservative, which is kind of what I said a long time ago. I mean, you and I have talked about the fact that we don't accept that particular label. Right. Because it doesn't mean anything.
No, it's lost pretty much all meaning at this point.
You know, John Roberts, supposedly conservative. I don't know who the three were who didn't vote for. Who did not vote. I know Scalia's one.
Oh, you mean who voted in dissent?
Thomas.
Clarence Thomas, Antonin Scalia, and Samuel Alito.
Alito. Okay, the three actual conservatives on the court, more or less.
More or less, yes.
When I say actual conservatives, they do occasionally use legitimate constitutional arguments.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, but you know what? You gotta give some credit where credit's due because Antonin Scalia, he brought it, okay? He brought it hard because he actually came out and said in his dissent that John Roberts was biased in favor of Obamacare. That's one justice saying that another justice had a conflict of interest in his ruling. If you have a conflict of interest, you're supposed to disclose that and recuse yourself.
Yep.
There's another potential grounds for articles of impeachment. I'm going to keep thumping that drum, Chuck.
We're really past time. I mean, we've had one Supreme Court justice who was impeached, and he was not convicted. And he should have been. And that's Justice Samuel Chase. If you want to, Justice William Rehnquist wrote an interesting book on that. And what I took away from that book, and I'm trying to remember what the name of it is, but if you look up Supreme Court and impeachment and mm-hmm. Rehnquist, you'll find it. What I took away from that book was the fact that Rehnquist was scared to death of the impeachment process, which is exactly why it's there. Now, if I remember right, Thomas Jefferson made the statement that the impeachment process, especially for judges, was nothing more or less than a scarecrow. In other words, he was saying it will do nothing because no one will ever use it. And guess where we are?
Yes.
Jefferson turns out to have been correct again.
Absolutely prescient.
I am a fan of Thomas Jefferson up to a point.
But he was a slaveholder, so we have to destroy the Jefferson Memorial. We have to get rid of any references, and we have to I guess Jefferson City, Missouri has to rename itself.
Apparently. Maybe. And we need to tear down all the Jefferson Davis memorials.
Okay.
You've heard it now suddenly with the. We have to tear down all of them that are in all the state houses across what used to be the CSA.
Well, and you know, I think the Civil War was so bad, and it brings up so many negative negative feelings on everybody, that we should just get rid of every reference to anybody who was related to the Civil War, including Ulysses Grant and Abraham Lincoln.
Well, we can all get together and pretend that the Confederate States never actually seceded. Voila, problem solved.
Problem solved, that's right.
And the slaves all just disappeared.
Thanks, John Roberts. We appreciate your giving us the leadership.
There you go. We'll take your hint. Okay, well, that's it for this week. We're out of time. Please join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.